Chapter 33. I looked at Zebra. She looked at me. Neither of us said anything. The vehicle into which the heavies escorted us had the reek of newness, leather trims, sweating sumptuousness. There was an isolated rear compartment with six seats and a mound-like central table, with soft muzak filling the air and elegant neon designs worked into the ceiling. Voronov and one of the heavies sat opposite us, weapons still at readiness. Quiddenbach and the other man entered the front compartment, visible only as smoky shadows through the partition. The car rose smoothly, with a soft snicking from the roof arms, like someone crocheting at great speed. "What did he mean, space?" I asked. "A place called the Refuge, one of the high orbital carousels," Voronov said. "Not that it makes any real difference to you. I mean, it's not as if you're just tagging along for the ride, is it?" Someone had mentioned Refuge since my arrival in the city, but I could not quite place the reference. "What happens when we get there?"
"That's for Mr. Rivich to know, and you to find out. You might call it negotiation, but don't expect to take too many bargaining chips to the table, Mirabel. From what I hear, you're all cleaned out."
I've still got a few surprises up my sleeve, but I sounded about as convincing as a drunk tramp boasting of his sexual prowess. Through the side windows I watched the hovering crystalline mass of Escher Heights recede, and, not inconsequentially, I saw the other car, the vehicle which did not belong to Zebra, unfurl its arms to maximum extension and commence following us at a polite distance. "What now?" I asked, ignoring the heavy. "Your game's up, Voronov. You're going to have to find a new mode of pleasure."
"It isn't about pleasure, you idiot. It's about pain."
He leaned forward, imposing his bulk across the table. He looked like Rivich, but his body language and manner of speaking was all wrong. There was no hint of a Sky's Edge accent, and his physicality would have been alien to Rivich's aristocracy.
"It's about pain," he repeated, "because pain is what it keeps away. Do you understand?"
"Not really, but go ahead."
"You don't usually think of boredom as something similar to pain. That's because you've only been exposed to it in relatively small doses. You don't know its true color. The difference between the boredom you know and the boredom I know is like the difference between touching snow and putting your hand in a vat of liquid nitrogen."
"Boredom isn't a stimulus, Voronov."
"I'm less sure," he said. "There is, after all, a part of the human brain which is responsible for the sensation we call boredom. You can't argue with that. And it must logically be made active by some external stimulus, just like the brain center for taste or sound."
He raised a hand.
"I anticipate your next point. That's one of my talents, you see. Anticipation. You might say it's symptomatic of my condition. I'm a neural net, which is so well adapted to its input that it hasn't evolved in years. But to return to the point in hand. You were doubtless going to say that boredom is an absence of stimulus, not the presence of a particular one. I say there is no difference, that the glass is both half empty and half full. You hear silence between notes. I hear music. You see a pattern of black on white. I see a pattern of white on black. More than that, in fact. I see both."
He grinned again, like a maniac who had been chained in a dungeon for years, and was now having a meaningful conversation with his own shadow.
"I see everything. You can't help it when you reach my, what shall I call it, depth of experience."
"You're quite mad, aren't you?"
"I've been mad," Voronov said, apparently not taking it as an insult. "I've been through madness and come out on the other side. Now being mad would bore me as much as sanity."
I knew he was not mad, of course, at least not screamingly insane. If he had been, he would have been no use to Rivich as a lure. Voronov had to have some residual grasp on reality. His mental state was almost certainly unlike anything I had ever experienced, and I had certainly known boredom, but it would be lethal to assume he was in anything other than absolute control of his faculties. "You could end it all," I said helpfully. "Suicide can't be the hardest thing to arrange in a city like this."
"People do," Zebra said. "People like Voronov. They don't call it suicide, of course, but they suddenly take an unhealthy interest in activities with a very low survival probability. like diving into the gas giant, or saying hello to the Shrouders. Why not, Voronov? And then it was my turn to smile. No, wait. You almost did it, didn't you? Posing as Rivage. You were hoping I'd kill you, weren't you? A way out of the pain with something approaching dignity. The wise old immortal, gunned down by the out-of-town thug, just because he happened to take on the persona of a murderous fugitive?
With no bullets? That'd be a trick worth dying to see, Mirabel.
Good point. Except, Zebra said, you realized you liked it too much. Voronov looked at her with ill-concealed venom.
Liked what too much, Tarin?
Being hunted. It actually eased the pain, didn't it?
What would you know about the pain?
No, I said. Be honest, Voronov. She's right, isn't she? For the first time in years you actually remembered what it was like to live. That's why you started taking stupid risks, to keep that buzz alive. But nothing was good enough, was it? Even jumping into the chasm was just mildly amusing. He looked at us with new eagerness.
Have you ever been hunted? Have you any idea what it's like?
I'm afraid I have had that pleasure, I said, and fairly recently, too.
I'm not talking about your little hunting games, Voronov said, spitting the words with total contempt. Scum in pursuit of scum, present company accepted, of course. When they hunted you, Mirabel, they stacked the odds so heavily in their favor, they might as well have blindfolded you and put a slug through your head before they even let you run.
Funnily enough, I would have almost agreed with you at the time.
But it could have been different. They could have made it fair. Let you get further away before they came after you, so that your death wasn't absolutely inevitable. Allowed you to find your hiding places and use them. That would have made a difference, wouldn't it?
Almost, I said. Of course, there would have been the small matter that I never volunteered for it.
Maybe you would have, too, if it was worth it. If there was a prize. If you thought you could make it through the game.
What was your prize, Voronov?
The pain, he said. It's absolution. For a few days, at least.
I started to answer him, probably. I think I did, anyway. It might have been Zebra, or it might have been the taciturn heavy with the bludgeon-sized gun. All I remember with any clarity is what happened several seconds later, the intervening moments neatly edited from memory. There must have been a pulse of light and heat at first, as the other car opened fire on us. Then there would have been a blast of eardrum-piercing sound as the shockwave of the beam weapon slammed through the flensed-open cabin, followed by an explosion of metal and plastic and composites as the car's innards eviscerated themselves in a hot cloud of fused machinery. Then we would have dropped as the shattered roof-mounted arms, amputated and twisted by the attack, lost their grip on the cables. A second or so later, our descent was arrested, violently, and that was when, approximately, something like normal consciousness resumed. My first memory, before the pain hit, was that the car was upside down, with the mound-like table now dimpling down from the ceiling, and the neon-patterned floor evincing a gaping, jagged hole through which the lower reaches of the city, the festering complexity of the mulch, was far too clear and far too far below. The heavy was gone, except for his gun, which was rattling to and fro on the new floor as the car lurched and swayed, adjusting to its precarious new equilibrium. The heavy's hand was still present, clasped around the gun. It had been neatly severed by shrapnel. Seeing the bony details of the wrist reminded me of the absence of my foot in the tent after we had been ambushed by Rivage's people. The way I had pawed at the stump and held my blood-drenched palm to my face, in abject denial that a part of me had been removed, like a strip of annexed territory. Except, as I now knew, none of that had happened to me. Zebra and I had tumbled into one corner of the cabin, thrown together in an untidy embrace. There was no sign of Voronov, or any parts of Voronov. I was being assailed by waves of pain, but as I began to pay particular attention to my discomfort, I decided there was nothing sharp enough to be actual broken bones. The car swayed and creaked. It was remarkably quiet, apart from our breathing and the soft moaning which came from Zebra.
Tana, she said, opening her eyes to pained slits. What just happened?
We were attacked, I said, realizing that she had had no knowledge of the other vehicle, that she had not been expecting anything at all, whereas I had been mentally tensed for some kind of intervention. A heavy beam weapon, probably. I think we're stuck in the canopy.
Are we safe? she asked, wincing as she untangled one limb.
No, wait. Stupid question. Incredibly stupid question.
Are you hurt?
Just a moment.
Her eyes, glazed as they were, conspired to glaze a degree more for an instant.
No,
nothing that can't wait for a few hours.
What did you just do?
Checked my body image for damage.
She said it dismissively. How about you, Tanner?
I'll make it, assuming any of us makes it.
The car lurched, slipping vertically downwards before something arrested its progress, shakily. I tried to keep my gaze away from the moor in the floor, but if anything, the mulch looked further away than ever, like a street map held at arm's length. A few of the lowermost merged limbs of the canopy intersected the view, but they were spindly and uninhabited, and served only to enhance the sense of tremendous height. Shadows moved beyond the smoky partition, and the vehicle budged again.
"Someone will rescue us," Zebra said. "Won't they?"
"Someone may not want to intervene in what is clearly a private matter." Then I nodded at the partition. "At least one of them is alive in there. I think we'd better move before they do anything we might regret, like shooting us."
"Move where, Tanner?"
I looked down at the gap in the floor. "We're not exactly spoilt for choice, are we?"
"You're mad."
"Just possibly," I said, kneeling at the edge of the hole, spreading my arms wide around the rim and preparing to lower my head through it. "But I find it goes with the territory, Zebra." I lowered myself through the aperture until my feet found purchase against the gnarled top surface of the canopy branch against which we'd come to rest. It was a narrow branch. We were very close to its extremity, where it tapered to a fine, tendrilled point, like the nub of an onion. Once I had my balance, I reached up and helped Zebra through, though with the extreme elongation of her limbs, she hardly needed my assistance. Zebra looked up, appraising the looming bulk of the ruined vehicle. What had been the roof was a mass of scorched and melted components, only one of the telescopic arms remaining, which was the arm which was holding the vehicle in place, clutching precariously and twistedly at a somewhat higher branch. It looked like it would take very little more than a breeze to send the whole mass careering down to the mulch. Quirrenbach and the other heavy, who'd been in the forward compartment, were inside, but they were struggling with the door, which was wedged against a protrusion from the branch. "Voronoff's still alive," I said, gesturing a little distance up the branch, where it thickened. He was crawling along it, slowly but methodically, and I decided the branch must have broken an otherwise unintentional fall.
"What are you going to do?"
"Nothing," I said. "He won't get very far." The shot was precise and surgical, sufficient yield to make a point, yet not enough to risk cutting through the branch. It made Voronoff stop in his tracks, but for a moment he did not look back in our direction. Zebra looked up into the overlying mass of structural branches where the figure who had fired the shot was standing. She stood with her hips slightly canted to one side, the stock of a heavy rifle resting against the convexity of one thigh. Chantrell shouldered the weapon, then commenced climbing down via an improvised staircase of linking branches. Above, her car was parked, intact, and three other dark-clad figures had spilled out onto the branch. They were covering her as she worked her way down to our level with even larger and nastier weapons. It was a small thing at first, just a smudge of phosphors on the deep radar screen, but it signified volumes. For the first time since leaving the flotilla, they had encountered something that lay behind them, something other than light years of empty space. Sky turned up the beam intensity and focused the phased array on the specific region where the echo had come back from.
"It's got to be it," Gomez said, leaning over his shoulder. "Got to be the Caluche. There can't be anything else out there."
"Maybe we're just seeing another piece of discarded junk," Norquinco said.
"No." Sky watched as the phased array teased out details, turning the smudge into something with density and shape. "It's much too big for that. I think it is the ghost ship. Nothing else that big could be trailing us."
"How big is it exactly?"
"Wide enough," Sky said, "but I can't get an estimate of the length. She's keeping her long axis aligned with us, just as if she still has some navigational control." He tapped keys, squinting as more numbers popped up next to the echo. "Width is spot on for a flotilla ship. Same profile, too. The radar's even picking out some asymmetries which line up with where we'd expect the antennae clusters to be on the forward sphere. She doesn't seem to be rotating. They must have sapped her spin for some reason." Maybe they got bored with gravity. How far away is she?
16,000 clicks, which, considering we've come half a light second, isn't bad. We can reach her in a few hours at minimal burn.
They debated it for a few minutes, then agreed that a quiet approach made the best sense now. The fact that the ship had kept herself aligned with the flotilla meant that it was no longer possible to think of her as a drifting dead hulk. She still had some autonomy. Sky doubted that there would be living crew aboard her, but it must now be considered a real, if remote, possibility. At the very least, automated defense systems might be functioning, and they might or might not take kindly to the swift, unannounced approach of another ship.
"We could always announce ourselves," Gomez said.
Sky shook his head. "They've been following us quietly for the best part of a century without ever making any attempt to talk to us. Call me paranoid, but I think that just might suggest they're not particularly interested in visitors, whether they announce themselves or not. Anyway, I don't believe for 1 minute that there's anyone aboard. She has some system still running, that's all, just enough to keep her antimatter safe and to make sure she doesn't drift too far from the flotilla."
"We'll know soon enough," Norquinco said. "As soon as we get within visual range, then we can take a look at the damage."
The next 2 hours passed agonizingly slowly. Sky modified their approach trajectory to take them slightly to one side, so that the phased array could begin to pick out some elongation in the radar echo. The results, when they came in, were no surprise. The Caliuche fitted the profile of a flotilla ship almost exactly, except for some small but puzzling deviations.
"Probably damage marks," Gomez said. He looked at the radar echo, bright now, and the absence of anything else on the screen only served to emphasize how isolated they were.
There had not even been any response from the rest of the flotilla. No sign that any of the other ships had noticed anything going on.
"You know," he said, "I'm almost disappointed."
"You are?" "At the back of my mind, I kept wondering if it wouldn't turn out to be something stranger."
"A ghost ship isn't strange enough for you."
Sky adjusted the course again, swinging them around to approach the ship from the other side.
"Yes, but now that we know what it is, so many possibilities are ruled out. You know what I used to think it might be? Another ship sent out from home, much later than the flotilla, something a lot faster and more advanced, sent here to follow us at a safe distance, maybe just to observe us, but perhaps to step in and help us if anything went seriously wrong."
Sky did his best to look contemptuous, but secretly he shared some of Gomez's feelings.
"What if it got worse?" he thought. "What if the Caliuche turned out to have no useful supplies on her at all, and no safe way of exploiting her antimatter?"
Just because something had spawned a myth did not automatically mean it had to contain anything of substance. He thought of the original Caliuche, the ghost ship which was supposed to haunt the waters of southern Chile, the dead aboard her trapped in an eternal and grisly celebration, sending mournful accordion music out across the waves. But whenever the real Caliuche was sighted, it always had the magical ability to turn into a seaweed-infested lump of rock or a piece of driftwood. Maybe that was all they were going to find now. The final hour passed as slowly as those that had preceded it, but at the end of that time they were rewarded with their first faint glimpse of the ghost ship. It was a flotilla vessel, all right. They might have been approaching the Santiago, except that the Caliuche had no lights on her at all. They could only see her by shining the shuttle searchlights, and by the time they had come closer, to within a few hundred meters of the drifting ship's hull, they could pick out details just one tantalizing spot at a time.
"Command looks intact," Gomez said, as the searchlight tracked across the huge sphere at the front of the ship.
The sphere was dotted with dark windows and sensor apertures, with comms antennae protruding from circular pits, but there was no sign of any inhabitation or power. The front hemisphere of the globe was pored with countless tiny impact craters too, but that was also the case for the Santiago, and at first glance this ship seemed not to have suffered any more damage than that.
"Take us further down the spine," Gomez said. Norquinco, behind them, was busying himself with more schematics of the old ship.
Sky tapped the thrusters lightly, sending them cruising slowly past the command sphere, and then the cylindrical module that followed it, the one that would have held the Caliuche's own shuttles and freight stores. Everything looked exactly as it should have done. Even the entry ports were situated in the same places.
"I'm not seeing any major damage," Gomez said. "I thought the radar showed."
"It did," Sky said, but the damage was all on the other side. We'll loop around to the engine section and come back up. They tracked slowly down the spine, the searchlights revealing circles of bright detail amidst greater darkness. Sleeper module after sleeper module passed by. Sky had started counting them, half expecting that some might be missing, but after a while he knew there was no point. They were all still present and correct. The ship, apart from the minor abrasive weathering, was still exactly as she had been when launched. "There's something about her, though," Gomez said, squinting, "something that doesn't look quite right." "I don't see anything out of place," Sky said. "She looks normal enough to me, too," Norquinco said, looking up momentarily from the far more interesting prospect of his data schematics. "No, she doesn't. She looks like she's not quite in focus. Can't you see that as well?" "It's a contrast effect," Sky said. "Your eyes can't deal with the difference in illumination between the lit and unlit parts." "If you say so." They continued in silence, not really wanting to acknowledge that what Gomez had said was true, and that there was something not quite right about the Caluche. Sky remembered what Norquinco had told him about the ghost ship story, how it was said that the old sailing ship had been able to surround itself with mist so that no one ever saw it clearly. Thankfully, Norquinco refrained from reminding him of that. It would have been about all he could take. "There's no infrared from the sleeper berths," Gomez said eventually, when they were most of the way down the spine. "I don't think that's a good sign, Sky. If the berths were still operational, we'd see the infrared coming from the cooling systems. You can't keep something cold without making heat somewhere else. The Momios can't still be alive." "Then cheer up," Sky said. "You wanted a ghost ship? Now you've got one." "I don't think there are ghosts on it, Sky. Just a lot of dead people." They passed the end of the spine where it coupled to the propulsion unit. They were closer now, only 10 or 15 meters from the hull, and the details should have been pin sharp, but there was no denying what Gomez had pointed out. It was as if the ship was being seen behind a screen of slightly mottled glass, blurring every edge except the one between the ship and space. It was as if the ship had melted slightly and then re-solidified. It wasn't right. "Well, there's no sign of major damage to the propulsion section," Gomez said. "The antimatter must still be inside, kept penned on residual power. But there's no sign of any power at all. Not a single running light. So she's turned off every non-essential system. But the antimatter has to be inside her, Sky. That means whatever happens here, our journey won't have been completely in vain. Let's see what she looks like on the other side. We know there's something wrong with her there." They curved around, executing a hairpin turn beyond the gaping mouths of the exhaust vents. Gomez was right, of course. The antimatter had to be there, and that had never been in doubt. Had her engines exploded the way the Islamabad had done, there would have been nothing left at all except for a few unusual trace elements added to the interstellar medium. There must still be enough antimatter inside her to slow down the whole ship, and all the containment systems must still be operating normally. Sky's people could use that antimatter. They could either experiment with it in place, testing the Caluche's engines in ways they would never have risked with their own ship, thereby finding a way to squeeze more efficiency from them, or they could use the ghost ship as a single huge rocket stage, tethering it to the Santiago, and enormously boosting their deceleration curve, before discarding the Caluche at some still significant fraction of the speed of light. But there was a third way that appealed to Sky more than either of those two possibilities. Gain experience with the handling of antimatter aboard the ghost ship, and then transfer only the reservoir back to the Santiago, where it could be connected up to their own fuel supply. That way, no fuel would be wasted decelerating dead mass, and the whole thing could be kept reasonably secret as well. Now they turned around and began to track up the other side. The radar scans had forewarned them that there would be some kind of asymmetry, something different about this side of the ship. But when they saw what it was, they had trouble believing their eyes. Gomez swore softly, Sky echoing the sentiment with a slow nod. All along her length, from the bulbous command sphere to the rear of the propulsion section, the ship's side had erupted outwards in a queasy leprous mass, a froth of globular blisters packed as dense as frog spawn. They studied it wordlessly for at least a minute, trying to rationalize what they saw with what they believed the sixth ship to be. "Something strange happened here," Gomez said, the first to speak. Something very, very strange. I'm not sure I like it, Sky.
You think I like it any more than you do, Sky answered.
Take us away from the hull, Norquinco said, and for once Sky obeyed him without question. He tapped the thrusters, pushing the shuttle out to 200 meters. They waited silently until they could get a better look at the ghost ship.
The more he looked at it, the more it looked like blistered flesh, Sky thought, or possibly badly healed scar tissue. It certainly did not look like anything he would have expected.
There's something up ahead, Gomez said, pointing. Look, tucked away near the command sphere. It doesn't seem to be part of her.
It's another ship, Sky said.
They crept closer, nervously probing the dark mass with searchlights. Almost lost within the bubbled explosion of flesh-like hull was a much smaller intact spacecraft. It was the same size as their shuttle, the same basic shape, in fact. Only its markings and details were different.
Shit! Someone got here ahead of us, Gomez said.
Perhaps, Sky said, but they could have been here for decades.
He's right, Norquinco said. I don't think it's one of ours, though.
They crept closer to the other shuttle, wary now of a trap, but the other ship looked equally as dead as the much larger craft alongside it. It was guide to the Caliuche, moored to her hull by three lines which had been fired into the hull with penetrating grapples. That was standard emergency equipment on a shuttle, but Sky had never expected to see it used in this fashion. There were intact docking hatches on the Caliuche's far side. Why had the shuttle not used those?
Bring us in nice and slowly, Gomez said.
I'm doing it, aren't I?
But docking with the derelict shuttle was much harder than it looked. Their own thrusters kept blowing it away. When the two ships did finally come together, it was with a good deal more violence than Sky would have wished. But the hatch seals held, and he was able to divert some of their own power to the other craft, booting up its own systems, which must only have been sleeping. It felt too easy, but the shuttles had always been designed for complete compatibility across the docking systems of all the ships. Lights stammered on, and the airlock began to establish equal pressure on either side of the lock. The three of them suited up and strapped on the specialized sensors and comms equipment they had brought along for the expedition, and then each took one of the security-issue machine guns with torches strapped to them, which Sky had appropriated. With Sky leading, they floated through the connecting tunnel until they were emerging in a well-lit shuttle cabin, superficially similar to the one they had left. There were no cobwebs or floating veils of dust to suggest that any time at all had passed since the shuttle had been vacated. A few status displays had even come back online. There was, however, a body. It was space-suited, and very obviously dead, although none of them wanted to look at the grinning skull behind the faceplate longer than necessary. But the figure seemed not to have died violently. It was seated calmly in the pilot's position, with the two arms of the spacesuit folded across its lap, gloved fingers touching as if in quiet prayer.
Oliveira, said Gomez, reading the nameplate on the helmet. That's a Portuguese name. He must have come from the Brasilia.
Why did he die here? Said Norquinco. He had power, didn't he? He could have made it back home.
Not necessarily. Sky pointed to one of the status displays. He might have had power, but he certainly didn't have any fuel. He must have burned it all, getting here in a hurry.
So what? There must still be dozens of shuttles inside the Caliuche. He could have ditched this one and taken another one back.
Gradually they formed a working hypothesis to explain the dead man's presence. No one had heard of Oliveira, but then again he was from another ship, and he would certainly have vanished many years ago. Oliveira must have learned about the Caliuche as well, perhaps in the same way Sky had, a slow accretion of rumor which had eventually hardened into fact. Like Sky, he had decided to go back and see what the ghost ship had to offer, perhaps hoping to score some massive advantage for his own crew, or, just possibly, himself. So he had taken a shuttle, secretly, one presumed, but he had also decided to make the dash at a high fuel expenditure. Perhaps he was forced into this strategy by a narrow window in which his absence would not be noticed. It must have seemed a reasonable risk to take. After all, as Gomez had said, there would be fuel supplies aboard the Caliuche, other shuttles, for that matter. Getting back ought not to have proved problematic. Yet evidently it had.
There's a message here, Norquinco said, peering over one of the readouts. What? Like I said, a message. From, him, I presume.
Before there was any time for Sky to ask him, Norquinco had called up the message, translated it through several software protocols, and then piped it through to their suits, with the audio track playing over the normal comms channel and the visual component projected as a head-up display, making Oliveira's ghostly form seem to join them in the cabin. He was still wearing the same suit he had died in, but now he had the helmet visor raised over the helmet's crown, so that they could see his face properly. He was a young-looking man with dark skin, and a look in his eye of both horror and profound resignation.
"I think I'm going to kill myself," he said, speaking Portuguese. "I think that's what I'm going to do. I think it's the only sensible course of action. I think, in my circumstances, that's what you would have done. It won't take any great courage on my behalf. There are a dozen painless ways to kill yourself in a spacesuit. Some of them are better than painless, I'm told. I'll know soon enough. Let me know if I died with a smile on my face, won't you? I hope I do. Anything else just wouldn't be fair, would it?"
Sky had to concentrate to follow the words, but it was not insurmountably difficult. A security officer, it had been his duty to have a good grasp of the flotilla's other languages, and Portuguese was a lot closer to Castellano than Arabic.
"I'm going to assume that you, whoever you are, have come here for much the same reason I did. Sheer unadulterated greed. Well, I can't really blame you for that. And if you've come here for some infinitely more altruistic reason, you must accept my very humble apologies. But somehow I doubt it. Like me, you must have heard about the ghost ship and wondered what she had on board worth plundering. I just hope that you didn't make quite the same miscalculation I did, concerning her fuel supplies. Or maybe you did, and you already understand exactly what I'm talking about, because you've been inside her. And if you do need the fuel, and you haven't been inside her yet, well, I'm sorry, but you have something of a disappointment coming. If that's quite the word I'm looking for."
He paused, glancing down at the top of his suit's life support tabard.
"Because she isn't quite what you thought she is. She's infinitely less, and infinitely more. I should know. I've been inside her. We both have."
"Both?" Sky said aloud. It was as if the man had heard him.
"Or maybe you haven't found Lago yet. Did I mention Lago? I should have. My mistake. He used to be a good friend of mine, but now I think he's the reason I'm going to kill myself. Oh, I can't get home without fuel, I know that. And if I asked for help, I'd be executed for coming here in the first place. Even if the Brasilia didn't hang me, the other ships would. No, there's really no way out. But like I said, it's Lago that really has me convinced. Poor, poor Lago. I only sent him to look for fuel. I'm really so very sorry."
Suddenly, as if snapping out of a muse, he seemed to look at all of them in the eye individually.
"Did I tell you the other thing? That if you can, you should leave immediately? I'm not sure I did."
"Turn the fucking thing off," Sky said. Norquinco hesitated, then obeyed, leaving Oliveira's ghost hanging there with them, frozen in the middle of his soliloquy.